Welcome to the wonderful world of wine. We are your hosts, Mark Lindsay and Kim Simone, exploring all things wine with you. Our program is supported by Franklin Public Radio, and you can find us on Facebook at The Wonderful World of Wine. Hello again, everybody, and welcome to the wonderful world of wine. How are you today, Kim?
I'm doing great, Mark. How about yourself?
I'm doing just fine. And today we once again are introducing our listeners to people in the wine world. And today we have a special guest, Len Prezzuti. Len, how are you today?
Great. How are you doing, Mark?
Everything is great. I'm so happy to talk with you, Len. It's been a long time.
And, it has been.
I just have to tell Kim and our listeners the little background of how I met Len. Len is a certified wine educator. He's a corporate wine educator. And I grew up in a family liquor business, wine business. When my parents wanted to retire, I needed to seek out some education in wine. And Len was the person who was offering it. And I had gone to Len to study for my certified specialist of wine. Len taught me many, many things, as he did, I'm sure, a lot of people listening in our area were educated by Len. Len, you taught me so much about not only how to taste wine, how to evaluate wine, but also how to take wine exams. One thing about you, Len, that you would teach a class, and then after people would take a test, you would actually stop us in the hallway to follow up what was asked so you could learn from that. So I appreciate everything you did for me, Len, and I just had to let everybody know our little background.
It's truly my pleasure. You know, it's kind of a responsibility, obviously, preparing people for exams, and you never know what they're going to ask. So that's why I always did follow through, because I wanted to do the best job I could in teaching, and it's important. Important when you're taking exams like that to realize what level they're going to.
It was always so important to get that feedback. You had so much knowledge about the education part and tasting. You taught me a lot of things, even to the point where, and I use it for my classes now, Len, is I'll ask people in the room how many people like this wine, how many people hate this wine. And you taught me early on, never say that you hate a wine. It's just not your style. And I think that was one of the biggest things that helped me as a wine retailer to learn.
That's, I think, an important lesson to learn in that, especially when we're in the business. We're there to help people find wines that they like. And we have to match the wine to their palate, which may not, isn't actually, that's for sure, isn't ours. So we have to explore their likes and dislikes and all that, and wines they've liked in the past and wines that they haven't cared for so much, to try to guide them. And I think it's really important to just to kind of get what the wine has to offer. And that's a big job. I remember when I first started learning how to taste and figured out how important that was, really kind of came home to me when I came home from a trip from Europe and I bought 50 cases of a wine that I probably should not have purchased. It was good, but it wasn't quite as good as I thought it was when I was over there tasting. So I really explored every factor that was involved in the tasting process, how the glassware affected it, how the temperature affected it, how going through that whole process. I learned a huge amount myself. Little things like when you're smelling the wine, take a deep double sniff and then put the glass down, because if you continue to smell it, you desensitize your nose to the specific aromas and flavors contained within the wine. I always kind of compared it to going into a freshly painted room. You know, you can't stand the smell, and then all of a sudden you don't even notice it. So little things like that. But the biggest one that I always have a hard time conveying to people is when you're doing that first taste. And I go through the whole thing of holding the wine in your mouth, you know, the whistling and the layer and that, but is not to pay any attention to that first taste, because that's your mouth reacting to that new wine. And it's not a read on what that wine's really about. Even more so when you're tasting a number of wines in a tasting. And that's not always easy to do. You know, that first impression, you always want to kind of take notes on that and everything. But it's just, I think, important to understand that second taste, using that first taste as your palate cleanser rather than trying to use something else. Anyway,
we've been interviewing people for a very long time, and I think that's the first time that that thing has ever come up, like how to really assess what this wine tastes like by making sure that not only is your palate clean, but that it is like prepped to really get that taste of that wine. A really great piece of advice for either our listeners who are in the wine industry or just for our casual drinkers out there too.
Yeah, it took me a long time to learn that. I really have a problem with so-called palate cleansers. Anything that you put in your mouth is going to affect the flavor of that next wine more than nothing. Even water strips your mouth of saliva, and it's wine interacting with the saliva in your mouth that creates flavor. As much as I know that, I've been to major tastings where I just got thirsty, and I drank a full bottle of water and went back, and then I wasn't getting anything out of the first wine I'm tasting at all. And I said, oh, yeah, okay. I've stripped my mouth of
what
saliva.
What have I done?
Yeah, you know, it comes back. It doesn't take a long time, but right. It's just important to know kind of everything that's going on there to get a read on the wine. And it's not critical to enjoying the wine in a home setting, but certainly if you're making buying decisions, it is.
And you always used to play around with things like that. I remember we did a German tasting, and I believe you used ricotta cheese to clean our palates.
Yes, yes. Now, there are situations, like there's an exception for everything. German wines can be tough because, as you know, the predicat levels just specify the ripeness of the grapes. And it's up to the winemaker how they're going to balance that off with the amount of residual sugar and the acidity. And where that comes into play is you can have a number of wines at the same predicat level, and some are going to be sweeter than others, and some are going to be a bit drier. And one of the things of tasting wine in order is once you have a slightly sweeter wine than the wine you're going to, my God, all bets are off. That really came home to me when I was at major tastings that we go to when you're tasting through 50, 60, 70 wines. And there were these two Chardonnays right next to each other, one with no apparent residual sugar at all. And I knew the second wine intimately because I'd been tasting it a lot in different settings. And it showed horribly to the point where I was asking myself, how could this be? Is it a bad bottle? And took my notes home. I always love to do research and research the wine that I tasted before it, which again, Chardonnay, no apparent residual. It did have a slight amount of residual sugar that was barely noticeable at all. I mean, I couldn't discern it, but it was enough to throw my palate off the tasting of that second wine. So in that German tasting, the ricotta cheese is the best thing I could find. I experiment with everything. Even when it comes to temperature of wine, I still take the temperature of my wines a lot because I'm decanting way in advance. Boy, there's this Echo de Lynchbosch 2012, I believe it is, that I go back and forth with friends, you know, that I know have purchased the wine and are drinking it. At one point, it needed 6 hours air to come around. And it really made a huge, big, big difference going into that sixth hour. Well, one of the things that gets a little tricky is you have the wine in a decanter and we're cooking in the kitchen. Mm-hmm. So the kitchen's warm. And when the wine warms up, if it goes beyond a certain point, it's tough to cool it back down. The temperature for me, especially of a Bordeaux like that, I really want it to be 67, 68 degrees. If it gets much cooler than that, it really emphasizes the tannins to the point where it throws the wine out of balance. And one of the reasons I'm really into aeration and temperature, as well as glassware, but those are things that you can use to really help enhance your wine drinking experience and literally make the wine taste better doing something that doesn't cost you any more money. That's the big thing for me too. If you spent that time aging the wine and everything else involved, you want to drink it at its very best. So that's the whole thing of when you decant. And that's the great thing about wine. You look at people in the wine community. I have a lot of friends. I'll make phone calls. I go to online websites to check to make sure we get it right. Now, while you're doing all this, it's super important to still keep it fun. So, you know, try to get it right. But hey, man, you know, it's not heart surgery here.
Yeah.
If you make a mistake, nobody dies.
Yeah. Yeah. We're still, at the end of the day, we're still in a fun, doing something
fun. Amen. Amen.
Yep.
And I remember many times, Len, we'd be tasting wine and you would say, we're just in a great business, right? I mean, it's just all about fun.
Yeah. Right? Yeah.
So as our listeners can hear, Len, not only very knowledgeable, but has passion for wine. And he is since retired from being a corporate wine educator, one of the biggest wholesalers in the country. And he's now onto a new venture, which we have to ask you about, Len, and we have to promote for you. You're doing a radio show that turns into a podcast like us. It's Wine by Design with Len on 1510 WMEX Boston. It airs Friday nights at 6 o'clock, and you can catch the podcasts online after. And I have to ask you, Len, how did this come up? And let our listeners know a little bit about the show. Kim and I have been listening to it and enjoying it.
Well, it's kind of interesting in that I was recovering from an operation. I won't go into any of that, but I wasn't in a super great place. And I wanted to get engaged with wine again because I'd kind of fallen away from it. I liked the station a lot. It's an oldie station. I listened to it a lot. I called in, you know, talked to the DJs and all that. So at one point, I talked to a person who turned out to be the general manager and producer, Ben Ravinovitz, and asked them if they had any need for someone perhaps doing a little wine spot. Turns out that Tony LaGreca, one of the station's owners, was doing a wine show on Fridays called Uncle Tony's Influential Italian Music Hour. So I started out by doing a little 10-minute spot on that. And I did it for a while. It seemed to go well, and it was very well received. And Tony said, you know, why don't you do your own wine show? And I jumped at the opportunity. It's really great in that. For me, it's perfect. I've been given a totally free hand in terms of content. And as you know from listening to it, it's pretty much wine education. I'm talking about some of the, you know, how to taste, wine and food matching, which is huge, huge, huge with me, and wine and health and closures. I actually had Dr. Sinclair on that talks about the wine and health and has done books on it. But anyway, it's just been a ton of fun, and people call in. There are not a lot of call-ins. That's starting to increase a bit, but it's just a blast. And it really had to do a lot with, I guess, especially in the beginning, I wanted to share some of the stuff I learned because I never took anything at face value that I read as much as I possibly could. I experimented with it. I never totally believed anyone. When I read about the temperature in wine, I went through a 3-month period where I took the temperature of every wine I tasted, other than at these mass tastings, just to get a feel for it. And at a certain point, I could actually tell the temperature of the wine within a degree Fahrenheit. I did the same thing with Riedel glasses. I actually met with George Riedel when he first came to Boston looking for a distributor. He had a number of glasses. He let me bring the wine, and my God, what an impression that made on me. There was just such an amazing difference from glass to glass, and I realized what a huge impact it would have. And he did it exactly the right way. He didn't set up any specific order. He had me bring a half bottle of Bordeaux and a bottle of a Chardonnay, and poured it in these different glasses, mixed the glasses up, and said, now I want you to order these wines by best to worst, both with nose and with palate. When I did it, it's exactly what his research said would happen, even to the point where in this half bottle, it was starting to develop some secondary characteristics. It had a little bit of bottle age on it. And I said, well, this one, I would switch these two glasses. The nose was better here and the palate was there. And it actually had to do with he had, at that point, an aged Bordeaux glass and a young Bordeaux glass. So I went through a 1-month period, mainly because I had to wash all the glasses, where I tasted every wine I had at home out of 11 different Riedel glasses to see what a difference it made. I love trying to figure out exactly what's going on. You probably know this, Mark. When it comes to food and wine matching, in the very beginning, now we're talking well over 30 years ago when nothing much of worth was written about wine and food matching, and much of what you read was just dead out wrong. My wife, who's actually a trained chef, and I went through a three-year period where we had 12 different bottles open in the house at all times, six whites and six reds of as varying character as possible. So we're talking like a Muscadet, a Sauvignon Blanc, a Chardonnay, and all that. We tasted through all 12 wines, the six whites and six reds, every night with the food we prepared, spitting, even with the wines that we knew were going to be actively bad matches, to see what those flavors that were created were. And I conservatively estimate that we did 10,000 matches in that three-year period in the beginning. We still do it. Now it's usually five or six wines that we'll have on the table, because we have a pretty good idea of what works with what, but we're looking for what works the very best with the particular food we've made. But again, I want to keep coming back to this, but it's got to be fun. It was entertainment for us. We just love doing it. And to this day, we cook, sip a little bit of wine while we're doing it, but then we're at the table. It's almost never the case where there's one bottle on the table. There's always multiple bottles, and we're trying different things with different dishes and all that. And it's just a blast.
Well, I have just figured out what I'm going to do during my retirement. Thank you for that idea. Have a dozen bottles of wine open and cook and just taste everything.
You know, it's the tricky bit now is wines really are changing.
One cuisine of the classic, is too. I mean, there's so
cuisine is too.
Much,
absolutely.
You know, so different from the way that we cooked even 20 years ago and 30, 40 years ago. Forget about it. Like, so many different recipes and different cuisines. And I have teenagers. The way that they eat and the way that I have brought up them to eat is so different than the food that I ate as a kid. So yeah, there's just so much more versatility, but also new flavors and new spices and new cooking techniques and all of these different things that are now just like everyday part of the food that we eat, and makes it so much more, I think, exciting for doing wine pairings, because it doesn't necessarily always fall into those classic rules and what you pair with what. And you know, I tell my students all the time that sometimes the mistakes you make in doing a food and wine pairing will teach you just as much about the art of doing it as something that's a really, really good match.
Absolutely. I mean, with me, there are no rules. We try everything with everything.
I love that. This. And I'm going to do more of that.
You come across things. I had a man, Pinotage, from South Africa.
I know that
with,
one.
You know that one?
I
Indian
do.
Butter chicken.
Mm-hmm.
It was a phenomenal match.
I'm always surprised.
I have to admit, I'd have to look back at my notes. I've been doing so many different matches lately. Oh no, I have to correct myself. With that particular one, it worked with that surprisingly well, but it wasn't a great match. What we did have that was a great match with that Pinotage that was like off the charts phenomenal was, this is going to sound odd, but chili with beans and meat that we put some chocolate habanero hot sauce in.
See, I don't think that sounds odd at all. Mark and I argue about food and wine pairings all the time because we have different philosophies, but Mark's whole thing is match the flavor of the food and the flavor of the wine. So I think that's exactly what you did with that Pinotage and with the chili, because you matched the earthiness of the Pinotage, but also that little bit of chocolatey note, which is often there. So...
Well,
I see why that would work.
Yeah, that's another great point that you're bringing up, because that came home to me very early on when I was just beginning to delve into all this stuff. I was doing some food wine matching classes at one of the adult center of education places. And there were horrible matches that I'm saying, well, who liked this? And someone put up their hand. And it really has to do with exactly what you said, how you classify the food and wine match.
Mm-hmm.
What happened was, it was something that we in the trade would consider a bad match that this person was tasting, but it was a Chardonnay with a dish redolent of garlic, and it made the garlic taste god-awfully bitter, like you burned it, and it made the Chardonnay taste god-awfully bitter, but at the same time, it was really a vibrant flavor,
uh-huh.
And he loved that.
And some people just like bitter.
Yeah. And it's, but that's the beauty of it. I mean, yeah. It's what you like. Exactly. What we took to doing was defining a wine and food match. We came up with five different categories. And the first one was where both the wine and the food tasted worse than they did on their own. The classic Bordeaux with a white flesh fish. Boy, the one that's made so often that people don't realize it is the oak-aged Chardonnay with dishes with a lot of garlic in it. Or, the wedding. I always
champagne
use
and wedding cake.
Yeah, the dry champagne in the wedding cake.
Yep.
You taste the champagne. Oh, my God, this is great. You know, and then you taste it with the cake and it's horrible. But anyway. So the first, both are worst. The second and third, it's one is to the point where it totally dominates to the others fading into obscurity. The fourth is something we took to calling ships passing in the night, where neither the food nor the wine was apparently changed. But there was this fifth level that we always aspired to, where both the wine and the food tasted better to a trained palate than they did on their own. And that's what we're searching for.
I had one parent, and I hit Kim with this maybe a year ago when we were doing a tasting. I was having a salad, just a plain lettuce, cucumber, tomato. And I picked up a cucumber and I was drinking wine, and I could not find a good match with just a cucumber, not seasoned, just a cucumber. And I want your food pairing suggestion for a wine with a plain cucumber.
Did you try Gruner Veltliner?
I did not. Would you
believe it or not? One of the reasons I ask is that is my go-to wine with arugula salad. There's something about the white pepper spice that I find in most Gruners. Now, here's where it gets tricky too, because if the Gruner gets too ripe, it loses some of the pepperiness and then some of the richness comes in and hurts the match. The match that really blew me away is oysters and muscadet. I mean, the classic pairing of all time, right? So I have a muscadet that I've always gone to. It's a Regattiere. It's like old vines, 50 plus 60 year old vines. But the big reason I went to it in the beginning was the Stelvin. It had a screw cap. And way back in the day, there was a huge, as you probably know, cork problem, especially with muscadets, because they're buying these cheap little corks. It's meant to be drunk in a year or two. But I always bought a case of it, and we get fried oysters to go very often. And, you know, we'll sometimes eat raw oysters, but mainly the fried oysters. And matches are remarkably similar. I just bought a case because I ran out of my previous one of the 2022 Regattiere Muscadet and had it with oysters, and it didn't work as well as the Blanc that we had on the table because it had more fruit than I've ever seen in an entry-level muscadet. It's always been that really refreshing, bright, crisp, mineral-driven, very little fruit. And this one now, I know 2022 is a warm vintage in the Loire, but still, over the past 20 years, I've had warm vintages of that muscadet, and it was never like this. So it makes you re-examine everything.
Climate change rearing its ugly head in the wine world.
We've been finding
a lot of that. Yeah.
I'm looking to lesser vintages. Now looking around, are there any 2021 muscadets?
Yeah. It's like the flip side of how we used to look at it. It's like, don't choose the warmer vintages. Choose the cool, rainy vintages where you've got underripe fruit. you had to pick it anyway. It's like, well, maybe that'd be better with my oysters. Yeah. I'm 100% with you on the muscadet and oysters. And I know exactly that wine you're talking about. And I have had quite a few really, really nice pairings of muscadet and oysters. And you're right. It is one of those absolute classic pairings in the whole wide world.
Yeah, exactly. Yep. To the point where I was doing a training at a restaurant that served raw oysters. And I served the muscadet. I was having them taste the muscadet with the oysters. They brought some oysters out. And one of the servers came over to me and said, you know, I hate oysters.
Oh no.
But I tried it with the muscadet and I actually liked it. You know? And
yeah.
My God, that happened years ago. It made such an impression on me because I thought oysters are one of those things that you either hate or love and there's no middle ground here. And that people don't usually change, but it's crazy.
You
You're listening to The Wonderful World of Wine, and we are your hosts, Kim and Mark. You can find more information about Mark on his website, franklinliquors.com, and more information about myself and my classes at commonwealthwineschool.com. This week, we are introducing and interviewing Len Prezzuti, who also has a radio show and a podcast. You can find him at lenwmex@gmail.com, and his show is Wine by Design with Len on 1510 WMEX. Welcome back to The Wonderful World of Wine. We are Kim and Mark, and this week our special guest is Len Prezzuti. At the beginning of the show, Mark gave his little story about how he knows Len and the influence that he had on his life and career in wine. And now I'm going to tell mine, because Len was the predecessor of my boss at Martin Yeti Liquors all way back when, a couple of decades ago, when I started in the wine business. When I knew Len, he was the wine educator at Martin Yeti Liquor Corporate. And every quarter, we would head on down to headquarters, and Len would have spread wine bottles throughout the tasting room. And for an afternoon, we got to taste and talk and learn and choose new wines to show in the store. And your enthusiasm for the subject matter certainly comes through in your show and as we are talking with you here today. And I just want to let our listeners know that he is exactly this way in real life, too. So even in a working environment, this is Len, and this is really how excited he gets about wine.
Well, I have to admit, it really does go back to if you can't have fun with wine, what can you have fun with? Seriously.
And it's so nice that we get to have fun at work, because this is what
Absolutely.
We all do for a living.
Oh my God. Yes, I just
pretty,
feel
pretty wonderful.
Yeah. So privileged. And to travel the world, South Africa, New Zealand, Australia, Italy, France, Germany, Spain, Chile, Argentina. I never would have done that on my own. I really do owe a lot of that to the Martin Yetis, who sponsored my travel wherever I wanted to go, pretty much.
We had been talking before we started recording a little while ago the show, and you had mentioned just how important it is to taste with other people and not taste wine in a vacuum, but especially in a professional setting where you had said we know objectively all about these wines that we are tasting. We don't necessarily have to dig into what's the acidity level, how are the tannins, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. But when you get to a certain point in your either career or experience with tasting wine, and then you have other people who also are just as into it as you are, that it's talking about those other things that you are experiencing when you're tasting that really brings out the magic of the wine, I think, and getting other people's impressions and interpretations and how we describe them, but also really how we feel about them. And I'm hoping that you still have the opportunity to do that in retirement and kind of in this next phase of your life. And it certainly sounds like you've got people that you taste with these days. So it's nice that you can continue to kind of carry that fun part of the wine journey.
Oh, absolutely. Because everyone does have their own individual palate, in that you have different thresholds of perception for pretty much everything. And it does give everyone, even all of us professionals, a different read on the wine. I've tasted with people that had an amazingly low threshold of perception for mint, and they would pick it out before anyone else in the group, often when no one else in the group picked it out. And I'd search for it and say, there is that little hint underneath. I actually am kind of getting it. So yeah, it actually helps you to get more from the tasting experience too.
It makes you a better taster too.
Absolutely. That's the thing. It never stops. And all of our tastes are evolving. But at the same time, we do retain that ability to be objective about it. I'm not overly fond of the over-extracted, super high alcohol wines. I find that once you get past this certain point of ripeness, that the grapes can kind of lose their sense of place. And I don't know, even when they're balanced, they're just very hard to match with food at the table and all of that. But one of the great things about being in the trade is, I've had a chance to taste hundreds, if not thousands, of them, and you get a good read on how they can be balanced within the context of that over-extraction. I still find everything about wine fascinating. I don't know. It's just you're always learning literally every day. And then, as you were mentioning too, the styles changing both of the food and the wine. There is a place on the North Shore of Boston that does an amazing Peking duck, with the hoisin and the pancakes and all that. And our favorite match with that is a Gewürztraminer from Alsace. But it seems like I've either looked up tech sheets or tasted through, I can't tell you how many now, and either they're way sweeter than they were. I mean, all Gewürz tend to have maybe that little touch of underlying residual, but these were to the point where it was almost dominating. And again, these are wines like Schlumberger, the Prince d'Herbe, that was always one of my favorite go-tos. It seems like everything I'm looking for in Gewürz now is either sweet, or I looked up some tech sheets on Domaine Weinbach wines that were 15% alcohol.
Yeah.
Give me a break. I mean, it just doesn't work with the food. But I found one almost by accident. The Chateau Saint-Michel Gewürz from Washington State is lovely. It's 12% alcohol. Little touch of residual, enough to handle the hoisin sauce and the match and all that. But it works pretty well. Not as well as the classic Gewürz from Alsace did in that pairing, but it's the closest thing we've been able to come to lately.
Interesting.
Len, one of the things we try to tell the listeners or inform them is ways to shop for wine. And now that you don't have that ability to walk down the hall and grab any bottle you want, and you're out there in the world shopping, I know on your show you mentioned how you shop at some local wine shops. What are you noticing when you're shopping for wine nowadays? What are your tips for shopping for wine now that you have to go out and get these wines?
Well, first of all, it's really important to find a wine store with a broad enough selection so that they have enough to choose from within the store. And then the other tip that I would give is get to know the wine buyer. Not the store owner, the wine buyer, and develop a relationship with them, explaining to them what you're looking for. Boy, I mentioned it on a show, the Francois Villard, a Northern Rhone producer, does this little Syrah that the buyer found in this little wine store, it's a couple miles from me, that's an $18 bottle. Now, this is a producer that makes $50, $60, $70 Cote Rôtis that routinely score 94, 95 points in the Spectator, a really, really great producer. And he turned me on to this wine that I may have had a while back. The reason I love Villard is he did this Viognier that was around the Condrieu region, but was above the elevation where they could actually call it Condrieu. And he made a little generic Viognier for years and years that way over-delivered and that you could actually mistake for an actual honest-to-God Condrieu, which with all of its complexity and all that good stuff. So I was familiar with him, but didn't recall having had this somewhat generic Northern Rhone Syrah that he did and was the wine buyer for this little shop that, oh my God, my combination of living room dining area is bigger than the shop. But he has a tremendous selection, things that you'd never think of finding. That's where I got the Pinotage. So there's that. And I do revisit one of the beauties of being in the business for as many years as we have. You have kind of go-to people that in different regions and different areas and that. And I seek out those wines to the point where I'll ask to purchase single bottles of them. And then when I find that I like them, I buy a case. The funny thing is that happened very recently with the Colomet Torrontés, I believe it was the 2022, that was drop dead spectacular. As you know, that grape's very difficult to deal with. People tend to pick it a little younger for the intense aromatics, one of the most aromatic wine grapes in the world. But you want to get enough flavor richness to kind of balance that out. If you go even a hair over in terms of ripeness, this god-awfully bitterness creeps in there. This wine was just so perfect in that it had all of those off-the-charts intense aromatics, but not only did it have amazingly vibrant acidity, but the grapes were just ripe enough to give you a slight kind of bitter orange oil note that was just subtle enough that it perfectly brought everything else in that wine into balance. And literally, I had the bottle open on the table and I was on the phone to the wine buyer of the wine store they shop at, and I ordered a case because I knew I was going to talk about it on the show and I was worried that it was going to sell out before
I have to tell you, I was listening to that show and I had that wine on my shelf, but I thought it was maybe a 23 vintage, and I'm surprised it was 22. I took it home and the next day I ordered three more cases.
Did you really?
Yeah, you were right. It totally changed it. When I first had it, it was more acidic, very closed.
Yes.
And now the profile, there was like this, I don't know, pineapple. Great. There was all this tropical fruits. It was just amazing. And it's only like $10. So I said, because of your recommendation again, I tried it again and I ordered more just because of that.
Oh, that's way cool. That I can't tell you how great that makes me feel. But it is funny. And the beauty of it is with that Stelvin, my theory is that wines, you know, everyone knows this, that they go through a life stage, wines alive. But one of the things that people don't talk about so much is early on in a wine's life, it has something that I took to referring to as baby fat fruit that it needs to lose. It usually only takes a couple months. You might also view it as the wine settling down. There will be a lot of different ways to describe it. But I do believe that that wine at this point in Stelvin, which, as you know, is 6 months older, 2022, coming from south of the equator than here, I think it's just settled into an absolutely beautiful place.
Back to kind of the idea of wine education and changing careers, and this seems to be an industry that we all sort of bounce around a lot, but still stick with wine, and still we often want to get that passion that we have for wine across to other people. You seem to have just as much enthusiasm for wine now when you are no longer in the business of selling wine. But when you were in the business of using education as a sales tool to get people to understand what they were selling when you were working in a corporate environment, how successful did you feel using education was as sales technique? Does that make sense?
Like, it absolutely does.
Because we always feel like when we're talking to people in the trade and we are trying to get across to them the importance of wine education, you know, there's always that little extra of, well, you know, it'll make you more money because it'll help you sell wine better.
But there is absolutely no question of that.
I've been wanting to ask you this question because you are like the perfect person in that position to kind of bounce this one off of.
Yeah, well, a lot of it has to do with, first of all, everything we talked about, all the how to taste is how to get the information from the wine to begin with. But the thing I love about wine is, especially in this technological age that we're in, the only way you can learn about it is through someone that's been there. I remember when I first got in the business and I would take classes, every class I could and all that, and I studied as much as I could and I tasted as much as I could. The question I most often asked is this really supposed to taste this way?
Mm-hmm.
And that's the thing. It's a wine you haven't had before. And that's the beauty of the wine business. Obviously, I think if you don't know how the wine is supposed to taste and someone's asking you for that type of wine, you don't know where to go. And your tasting ability will allow you to taste through the portfolio of wines that you're selling and make the right choice. For a while, I ran a route selling wine. Sold to the Ritz. I sold to some of the top restaurants in town, which I loved. I loved the interaction with the chefs. My favorite pasta dish to this day, Vinicio of Toscano taught me how to make. He saw how into the wine and food thing I was. He took me back in the kitchen. And it had to do with these different herbs and spices and double smoked bacon. And it's an amazing dish.
Had me at bacon.
But again, it's that interaction and it's that learning and being able to help your customer. That's the way I always viewed it. And the more I learned, the better able I was to do that. And it gave me satisfaction. It might sound odd, but I never looked at my numbers. The thing that I always took care of all my customers as if they were family, quite frankly. I mean, it's just I couldn't do it any other way. And that always worked. I mean, it came through to them that I wasn't just trying to sell them something. I wanted to do what was best for them. And I think you can't do that unless you are educated in terms of wine. The more you know, the better able you are to do that. The more styles of wine you've tried, the more regions and all that, because it's just such a beautiful world out there. And what bothers me sometimes is, it happened to me once at a restaurant where I was helping them with the wine list, and they were blind tasting, which I'm a huge fan of, through a number of Chiantis. And they put together a few wait staff, and they came up with this wine that, okay, we agree, this tastes the best. And I was there, and I had to tell them what I thought. I said, you know something? I agree with you. This is good wine. The only problem is it tastes absolutely nothing like Chianti. And that's it. If you don't have that knowledge, how do you know what a good Chianti is? I mean, you have to have that point of reference of having tasted many, many of them. And again, that kind of goes back to educating yourself by tasting and learning. A lot of the learning has to do with things that will help you to taste better and learn about the region and the grapes involved and what the characteristics are. Reading about them helps you to place that wine in the filing cabinet in your mind under that grape from that region. And that's why I love wine education. I don't know. Sometimes people, education, you know, oh my God, do I really have to? You know, but I always tried to keep it fun. I think part of that had to do with the fact that I made a living 20 years playing saxophone. And I always liked to see people enjoying themselves. That's why I like the music. And I found that when I got into the wine business, that continued. I seemed to be able to help people have a better time. That's what it's all about, that enjoyment level. And I know it seems like maybe I went far afield from the wine education question, but I do feel that it's all tied in together. It's like when you listen to music, if you have a history of that composer and the era in which he or she composed, it helps you to better appreciate the sounds, even though the sounds are the same if you don't have that background. Mm-hmm. And I think wine is much that same way, that you have an even greater appreciation when you know what goes into it. And the beauty of what we do is we so often get a chance to meet the winemakers and the owners and the people that are putting their heart and soul into that product in the bottle.
Well, thank you so much, Len. We could talk all day. And
I know, no kidding. It's
like, so many questions.
Keep going?
Yeah, so many questions, so much to talk. And your passion is just, that's what we wanted to bring to our listeners today. And we thank you so much for the time.
Yeah, thanks, Len.
The pleasure's truly mine. I can't tell you how much I've enjoyed this. Thank you.
Thanks. It was good to get back in touch with you.
Thank you for joining us today on The Wonderful World of Wine. We've been your hosts, Mark Lindsay and Kim Simone, exploring all things wine with you. For more information about Kim, you can find her at her website, commonwealthwineschool.com. For more information about myself, please go to franklinliquors.com. Today, you've heard from certified wine educator Len Prezzuti and his passion for wine. If you'd like to hear more from Len, you can follow him on his radio show, Wine by Design with Len, on 1510 WMEX Boston. And you can find his past episodes on the WMEXBoston.com website. He's on Friday nights live at 6 p.m. You can find our past episodes on SoundCloud and iTunes. Cheers.
Cheers.